Good morning, and welcome to the CIBC Industrials Call Series. This morning we have SNC-Lavalin. As you may all know, the format is a virtual fireside chat, so if you have any questions, please email me at jacob.bout@cibc.com. So from SNC, we've got Ian Edwards, CEO, Jeff Bell, CFO, and Denny Jasmine also on the line. Good morning, gentlemen. Trust all is well.
Yeah, good morning, Jacob. Yeah, all is good.
Good.
Good morning, Jacob.
I wanted to talk, maybe start off just talking about, the current business environment with this pandemic. And I know, things are starting to ease, things are a little different in various geographic areas. So maybe just talk about, what you're seeing, are things getting back to normal here, Canada, UK versus Middle East?
Yeah, and I think probably the first thing I'd say is, obviously our business is spread over the globe, and our business is really both physical and desktop. So there has been different timing and different kind of impacts for the business. In the main, I think our physical work in projects and operations and maintenance have deemed essential and have maintained productivity and maintained work continuity. And with our desktop, which is almost 30,000 people globally, we were able to get everybody working remotely very, very quickly. And I don't think that's unlike other companies. And then the impact really has been progressive geographically, obviously with some impact in Q1 for Asia Pacific, move into the Middle East, and then further impacts in terms of having to take this remote working approach as it moves through Europe to North America. And I think in the main, whilst there are clearly some revenue fluctuations, in the main productivity, utilization and business continuity has been surprisingly robust. So, I mean, that's a very, very high level kind of answer to the question, I know, and I'm sure we'll get into a bit deeper dive in various aspects.
Yes. So, but in general, how close to you are you to getting back to normal? And how are you thinking about this getting back to work process in the office?
Yeah. I mean, I would say that Australia, South China, Hong Kong, Macau, they're probably back to normal. And they're leading that. I would say we're far from back to normal as far as being physically in our offices and working as we did pre-COVID in Europe and North America. But having said that, then there will be some lasting benefits of the way we've been working. Going forward, beyond COVID and post-COVID. I mean, certainly the agility of being able to work remotely and the agility of being able to collaborate across geographies very, very quickly without having to be physically in the same room and, having physical meetings with clients, I think is one of the benefits that we will look to maintain. But as far as getting everyone back, into the office and getting everything back to normal, we're not there, and I can't see that in the really near term either.
Okay. How about bidding on new work? Where's the status of RFPs right now?
Yeah, I think it's hard to generalize because the situation both from geographical and business line varies, but if you wanted to give a general statement, and again we can as we look further into the the business lines, I can give you a bit more detail. But if you want a generalized statement, I'd say as we hit this crisis, I think clients took a pause. And then as we've moved further into the crisis, I think everybody started realizing that, you know, work can actually operate and business can operate almost as efficiently. And things from an RFP, from a workflow perspective, began to come back after the initial impact of the crisis and remote working. So an exception perhaps to that would be the Middle East, I think, because of both the impact of oil price and COVID. I think we may see some longer-lasting impact there. Obviously, still very dynamic, still evolving. But I think we'll see a return to kind of more normal workflows as we come out of this.
Yeah, maybe just a bit of context here, but you know, one of your competitors yesterday was saying, you know, RFPs down in April, but basically back to normal levels in May. Is that kind of how what you've been seeing as well?
I tend to align with that, with the exception of the Middle East. I mean, I think we get to see, you know, I think there's a more conservative approach by governments and companies there because of the oil price impact. And I think we need to see, you know, what that looks like as we come out of the COVID crisis and perhaps they reassess their kind of budgets.
And have you seen any? Sorry, go ahead.
No, but directionally, I would agree with the statement. Yeah.
Okay. And then on backlog, have you seen any cancellations at all?
I think the biggest impact on us was that we have an onshore project in Newfoundland for Husky. That project was postponed a year. It's not cancelled. It was postponed. So it's not a backlog impact. It's a, you know, it's an impact for 2020. I think other than that, as I said, you know, perhaps a bit of slowing at the beginning, but nothing major from a cancellation perspective.
Right. And there was also that Darlington work that was pushed out to fourth quarter as well.
Yeah. And even Darlington, I mean, you know, we're the position there could be Q3, could be Q4, more of it a deferment to focus on the, you know, the first commissioning of the reactor, which has been very successful, but not a very significant impact for us, because even you know, with a Q2 start as originally planned, you know, the start phase is quite slow. So not a significant impact for 20 for us.
Okay. Why don't we dig into the specifics then and maybe sure. Start off with the EPDM. You know, the margin squeeze that we saw in the first quarter, I think you blamed it on, you know, theme work in the U.S. Or less theme work in the U.S., lower Middle East, or oil in the Middle East and COVID impact in APAC. You know, have these issues abated and are you seeing any improvement there?
Yeah, I think the issues as we were trying to describe them were very specific. That as you rightly said, I mean, it gave us a squeeze in Q1. So what we've seen since that is that revenues are clearly the impact on revenues is not zero. However, the revenue impacts that we are seeing, we have implemented a range of measures to adjust our cost in line with those revenue fluctuations. And those, you know, those are a range of things from from salary cuts that we've all taken across the whole business to adjusted working weeks to furloughing and ultimately, you know, restructuring through through redundancies where we don't see any work coming back. And in the main, again, that impact in the Middle East, the impact everywhere else is not zero, but I think we're tracking pretty strong as we as we have got past the initial phase of this kind of COVID impact.
Okay. So if I'm hearing you correctly, some improvement into May from April. You know, what does this ramp back look like in your mind then on the margin side?
My observation would be, and just to make the link from sort of Q1, you know, to where we're headed, you know, as there were a number of, you know, one-off items in Q1. I think our observation was, notwithstanding that, in a pre-COVID environment, the outlook that we gave at the, you know, at the end of Q4 last year, you know, of a set of EBITDA and EBIT percentages, you know, was very much, you know, in line with what we would have expected to deliver in the year pre-COVID. And as a part of that, you know, we knew that Q1 would be, you know, lower than what the sort of average was we'd see in the full year. And I think, as Ian has said, you know, as we've moved into Q2, we've taken a number of measures to, you know, look to mitigate some of the loss in revenue that we were seeing, but with a very, you know, clear eye to, you know, moving over time and in the year towards those margins that, you know, that we had talked about previously.
Okay. And I think you've said in the past, it's, you know, 75% of the EDPM work is government related. You know, what parts of the government are you seeing, you know, weaknesses, strength? I know you said that you're seeing some softness in April. You know, how are things looking right now as well on the government side?
Yeah. I mean, I think it was more a question of, rather than seeing, you know, specific areas softening, it was more a pause, you know, as we kind of hit this crisis and everybody was moving to remote working and trying to understand what the real impact would be. For sure, I think having 75% of our EDPM revenues coming out of the public sector is a good thing. Over half of our revenues are in transport, in road and rail, and I think those sectors are still strong, and I think they will be strong. I think the remaining part of our revenues are really also in areas such as water, you know, development of city planning, aerospace to some extent, and I think that if there is a lasting impact, it's probably less from the government sector, more from the private sector. I mean, clearly, as we come out of this, governments are looking to, you know, invest in infrastructure to try and get an immediate economic impact and boost to employment, where also they can see a longer term economic benefit from infrastructure itself. So we're really kind of moving on the front foot there, so to speak, to try to partner with government to get some of this investment and some of these projects so-called shovel ready and get them into the economy and stimulate. So actually, you know, because of our mix of work and the geographies that we are present in, save for the Middle East, which we've talked about, I think we're feeling pretty good about that.
Okay. Maybe turning to nuclear, on Bruce, you know, is this new work still expected to commence in July and August as per the original plan?
Yeah, or before. So, yeah. I think Bruce is pretty much on target to restart. As you said, Darlington, the first reactor was completed. That's now operating at 100%, but really successful commissioning. And as you said, the next reactor to be shut down was initially delayed through to Q4, but we may see that coming back in Q3. So on the whole, our nuclear sector has been really quite robust. If you take the sector on the whole, with the exception of those things and, you know, those specific projects in Canada, I mean, we're not seeing delays in our decommissioning. Our nuclear cleanup operations in the US, we're not seeing an impact there. Our new build in the UK continued at the Hinkley Point, so that was good. So, you know, one of the pleasing aspects of our business mix and our diversified portfolio between our SNCL engineering services business and EDPM Nuclear Capital NIMFRA services. I think one of the good things is, you know, as we hit this, you know, some of our business lines, such as nuclear, you know, the impact is very, very small and quite a robust business.
Okay. There was two new CDI JV decommissioning projects you had at the backlog in Q1. You know, what does that pipeline look like, you know, going forward? Still very robust?
I mean, obviously, you know, many, many nuclear power plants were built in the 70s and 80s. And as they come to the end of life, different governments deal with them in different ways. Some of them, you know, mothball for a while. Some want to actually get on with the decommissioning and remediate the land back to contamination free. So it is a strong pipeline. I mean, our current drive is in the US with our partner, but we're also seeing opportunities in both the UK and Canada and potentially beyond. So it's a very, you know, it's a really strong market and what we see is a strong part of the nuclear business going forward. And of course, you know, the great thing about these projects that we like so much is that they're reasonably low risk projects, you know, where safety is the key, not to put them under a time or a hard dollar kind of contract procurement environment. So we really feel good about this particular, you know, aspect of the nuclear business.
Could you quantify, you know, what type of annuity this could be?
Well, I don't think we've kind of quantified that externally yet from a growth perspective. You know, we did put some partial guidance out in 2020, which we took off when we went into COVID. So I think once we get past the COVID and then get back to normalized, we'll be looking at giving further guidance on that in the future, but not right now.
But on the nuclear side, between, you know, the ramp and Bruce and Darlington and the steady state decommissioning work, it sounds like the second half is going to be pretty good.
Yeah, I think we feel the impact is pretty minimal on this business. Yeah.
Okay. On the capital side, you know, 407, you know, volumes have been down strong. No dividend declared for April. You know, what type of improvement are you seeing there, and you know, what are your expectations as far as dividend payment?
Why don't I do that? I mean, I think our sort of first observation, you know, would be that, you know, until we start to see, real restrictions easing, in Ontario, we'd imagine that the traffic would continue to be, fairly suppressed. I think frankly, the rate at which those restrictions ease, you'd probably expect traffic to change, in a concomitant sort of manner. But, the level at which it eventually gets back to, I think that's hard to forecast. And frankly, it would be up to the 407 itself to, to comment on where traffic patterns are currently and, how they may or may not see that coming back. But as a shareholder, that's probably the demeanor that we'd hold to that. And I think therefore, the same can be said of dividend, payments that, I imagine that as shareholders we'll have to sort of wait to see how the how traffic continues and moves forward.
How about the performance of the rest of your concessions in the portfolio?
Yeah, the concessions in the rest of the portfolio are basically all availability concessions, really don't have much of any sort of usage components to it. So they've performed just fine. They've been available, and really we haven't really seen any changes from that perspective.
Okay. I want to move on to SNCL projects, resources in particular. So maybe just comment on, the runoff of the LSTK resource projects. I know there's not much left, but with COVID, it sounds like, I think originally you're thinking majority would be complete in 2020, but could this bleed into 2021?
Yeah, so as you say, we're down to $300 million of backlog now. So quarter on quarter, we've been able to keep liquidating the backlog, so to speak, on the resources projects. The impact, isn't zero on these projects through COVID. The projects have not been suspended as such or postponed, but travel in the region in the Middle East was prevented for some time. We're seeing that come back now. And mobility of people were obviously affected because of that. I think we're probably looking at a Q1 closeout in the main of these projects. So there has been some pushback from the original expectation within 2020. Some of the impacts of these projects are covered through contractual provisions. It may take time to recover that. There may be a timing impact, but it's not significant. It's not significant. Now we're down to the bottom end of the with $300 million backlog left.
So is this break even, once you account for the, some of the timing impacts here of the increased cost?
We're talking about the projects alone?
Yes.
Well, as you've seen, the last three quarters have been losses. I wouldn't call those losses significant as we've kind of burned through the backlog. I'd see a similar sort of trend through to the end.
Okay. Maybe moving on to the infrastructure part of the SNCL. The REM LRT reopened. Back to work on the project. And the cost of being shut down, who bears that?
Yeah, so with all of the, without kind of being specific project by project, let me give a kind of an overview of the 2.6 billion of backlog in the Canadian standard contracts. You're right. In Quebec, we had a delay from late March through to the 11th of May, and that was shut down with the government guidelines. In Ontario, the projects continued. So our Eglinton project, our Ottawa project, our Trillium project in Ottawa, and also continued, and we spoke about Husky previously. So the contracts in Canada are quite strong in our favor for events such as this. There are provisions both for change of law and force majeure. So we would expect to recover our loss on these projects for any impact.
Okay. And I think in the quarter you were $4 million contribution from infrastructure EPC. Is that kind of how we should be thinking about this go forward?
Sorry, yes, sorry, one was Jeff. I was coming off mute. I mean, I think our observation, what we've said publicly is that over the course of these projects, we would expect them to be, operating cash flow and cash flow neutral over time. By and large, you'd expect, profitability to probably follow that. One of the things we've said is that, certainly from a cash flow perspective here in 2020, the cash flow can be a bit lumpy. And we expect them to be a user of cash in the current year. And as you move through, progress of completion, we can see a bit of variability associated with that as well from a, from a P&L perspective. So, I think all of that, would need to be taken into account if you're sort of projecting it forward.
So the lump sum turnkey, dragging cash in 2020, but 2021 things should start to improve a bit, or?
Yeah, I mean, it's not so much, so you're absolutely right. We've given guidance on 2020. We haven't given guidance on sort of 2021. We've simply said over the course of the projects, they'll be cash flow neutral to cash flow positive. For some of the longer ones, we may have periods again where, it's one side of the line or other in a particular quarter or 6 month period or year. But you're absolutely right. As we continue to deliver and run off the backlog of the variability of that in any particular period starts to narrow, obviously, as well.
Okay. Maybe while I got you, Jeff, maybe talk about receivables, any changes in collectibility of receivables or extended.
Yeah.
And then maybe talk a bit about the difference in collectibility of public versus private.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually where I was going to go to begin with was, as Ian has talked about, we have a large public sector component of the business. And in fact, what we've actually seen in some geographies is the government trying to be quite helpful as they look to inject liquidity into the economy. An easy way for them to do that is to actually pay more quickly. So we had a good example of that in the UK, where effectively the UK government, indicated that on the presentation of a valid invoice, they basically pay on invoice as opposed to, waiting 30 or 60 days to pay. So we've seen, we've seen that being a positive impact. I would say on the private sector side, we generally haven't seen, any material deterioration in payment terms. Not surprisingly, the one we're managing quite closely and have a lot of focus on is the Middle East, where, in normal times, it's business, it's a longer payment period, and we're very focused on that. But overall, we haven't seen any material impact on that.
Okay. And then I guess liquidity, what do you think, $2 billion in cash in hand and the ability to draw down another billion? So pretty good shape.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we've we all remember the financial crisis of 2008, 2009. I think the lesson learned there for everyone was, you know, you can never have enough financial flexibility and liquidity when you're heading into those sorts of environments. And, you know, we may have moved very quickly, as Ian talked about, on the cost base, but we also moved very quickly on from a liquidity and financial flexibility perspective. And, you know, the company is well set up that way. And as you say, we had about $1 billion in cash. We drew $1 billion on our $2 billion line. And, you know, we think that has put us in, you know, in a very good position. We continue to, you know, explore ways of increasing our financial flexibility and liquidity, but, you know, are content with, you know, certainly where we are at the moment. And, you know, we've continued to manage that, you know, very closely as we've moved through Q2. You know, one of the elements of Q1 was, you know, a real focus on operating cash flow, and, you know, that focus on cash flow going forward, you know, will continue and remain. And, you know, that's the other sort of operational way you can sort of help yourself on that front.
So what would your target net income to free cash flow conversion be then?
Well, I think at this point, as we've talked about, particularly with the LSTK projects moving around the way they do, it's a much more difficult, you know, number to forecast. And it's one of the reasons why we don't give a lot of guidance, you know, from that perspective. I think as we transition the portfolio over time with the rundown of the LSTK projects, the services businesses themselves, engineering services, you know, has a much more stable and less variable type of operating cash flow profile to it. And I think, you know, therefore, as we, you know, come to the end of the year and into next year and see a much larger proportion of that LSTK project running off, then I think we'll be in a much better position, you know, to talk more about the sort of cash flow conversion, you know, percentages that we might look to see, the sort of cash flow targets we'd be looking to set, and the capital allocation framework that would go around all that.
Okay. Ian, wanted to talk about the, you know, infrastructure stimulus and, you know, the fast tracking of the existing pipeline. Mm. You know, what are you seeing there, and you know, what are some of the opportunities by business line?
Mm. So, yeah, I mean, we've been giving this quite a lot of thought, actually, and primary geographies. I mean, for sure, what we've seen in the past and at times of crisis, you know, just to take the 2008 financial crisis, we've seen a lot of will and intent from governments to stimulate the economy through infrastructure. The reality is that it's taken time to get those projects to so-called shovel ready, so that actually construction companies can commence the projects and create jobs and put real dollars into the economy. So clearly now our interest is in the services part of developer infrastructure. Both from inception through design, oversight, project management, operation and maintenance. And what we have created is an initiative called ASRI, which is accelerating shovel-ready infrastructure, that we're in discussion with governments in our primary geographies to actually try and partner and offer our capability to solve this time period issue of having the intent to stimulate the economy and actually getting the shovel in the ground. So we're pretty excited about this. We do see some, you know, best-in-class examples globally where the approach here of partnership between private sector and government has worked really well. And we are, you know, optimistic that we can be really helpful and obviously gain valuable work from that. And I see that the will of either states or provinces or federal or governments is absolutely to find this solution.
Do you expect to see a ramp in P3s outside of Canada?
I personally don't see P3s being the solution. I think the procurement tail. The procurement duration for a P3 project is long. I think the model itself has ending its useful life. That's my view. I mean, Australia has kind of moved away from it. The UK has moved away from it. Canada is struggling to get, a good number of bidders on the list. We certainly will not take part in the LSTK portion of a P3. We're very happy to do the design, very happy to invest, very happy to be the operator. But as these projects have got bigger and bigger, as I've said before, the risk transfer, it's just not equitable to the reward, in my view. I mean, not all companies take that view, but I think a lot have got to that point.
So what structure would you recommend then?
Well, integrated project delivery or integrator approach, where really the government partners with a project delivery partner. That project delivery partner basically does everything and then procures down to local or regional construction companies to actually do the build in manageable size projects. And there are good examples in the UK, good examples in Australia where this approach has worked well. You actually focus there on aligning the objectives of all stakeholders for a successful outcome, rather than have this huge transactional approach that the P3 has. So that's what we're advocating. I think that's what's necessary in the industry to move the industry forward. And as I said, there are good examples of that. And clearly, for ourselves, with our range of capability, we're somewhat unique because we have the ability to deal with the inception of a project through design, through construction oversight, project management, procurement, all the way through to operations and maintenance, because we've been one of the leaders, in that field through the P3 model. But as I've said, numerous times, I think it's had its day because the risk reward profile really doesn't work.
If you take a step back, Ian, and you think about the journey that S&C has been on, where do you think the company is at? What type of tweaking still needs to be done, and how do you think the employee morale has held up?
Yeah. So, I mean, when we decided to take a different direction in July last year and focus on professional services, focus on leveraging our capabilities primarily in the infrastructure markets and the nuclear market, using all the capability that we've developed in the past, but not put that, not put the company at risk through lump sum turnkey construction, that those were all the right decisions. And obviously our focus is to, work through our legacies and put our legacies behind us, and then focus on the future part of the company under SNCL Engineering Services to develop all of those business lines, and continue to grow our capability and grow our market share in our primary markets. I think that we all feel in SNC-Lavalin we are on the right road. Not all the challenges are behind us, but a lot of those challenges are becoming behind us. And we all feel we're on the right road, and we feel that with the depth of capability we've got, that we can lead not just S&C, but lead some of the changes that are necessary in the industry to actually produce better assets more efficiently. So we're feeling pretty good. Now, one interesting factor I'll probably give you is clearly, we've lived through a crisis. I mean, we were potentially in a media crisis in 2018, we had performance issues at the end of 18 into 19. And I think our teams and our people are pretty resilient and pretty battle-hardened. And as we've faced this crisis together as a company of COVID, I think we've been pretty solid. You know, I think we've been pretty resilient. So I'm happy with the teams. I'm happy with morale. Obviously, we've just completed another survey actually that detects what the morale in the company is, and it's continually improving, and it even improved through COVID in the main. So I think we're absolutely on the right road. You know, we've got work to do. We're focused on continual improvement, focused on our future business lines, but we all feel we're pretty much on the right road here.
And what are the major challenges left in your mind?
Getting the legacy behind us. I mean, you know, we want to put the LSDK projects behind us. You know, they need management. We have obligations to our customers to fulfill, and we will fulfill those obligations. But putting that behind us, finally putting that behind us, is something we're focused on doing as well as we can, so we can focus on the future.
Okay. Last question here, just, you know, kind of, we're still in the midst of this pandemic, but, you know, what do you think you've learned here? You know, what are the new ways of doing business? Like, how do you emerge on the other side of this? And, you know, maybe talk about any potential new product offerings you're thinking about.
The key learning, which I am intent on retaining in the business, is the agility and collaboration across the whole group. I mean, you know, clearly we have 44,000 employees. You know, the primary geographies of the US, the UK, Canada, you know, with, you know, still a reasonable presence in the Middle East and Asia Pacific. What we have learned through this is that there are no geographical boundaries to collaboration. I mean, and if we can retain that in, you know, really leveraging off the group strength to provide those services to our customers, you know, regardless of geography, I think we've really learned a valuable lesson and really developed a valuable skill that will help us for the long term. And examples of that now that we're focused on post-COVID is to look at capability that we have in a specific geography. For example, our pharma business in Canada and our pharma business in North America, in the US, is how do we leverage that capability to other geographies, as we will clearly see pharmaceutical opportunities. And that's just one example. And we have a hit list of post-COVID initiatives where we are looking at business such as that and sales opportunities such as that, where we will look to, you know, improve our geographical footprint of certain capabilities that we have. So that's something we're all pretty excited about, and also something which we're pushing hard in the company to get everybody out of the mindset of COVID and into the mindset of post-COVID.
Okay. Anything else you'd like to add, Ian or Jeff?
I don't think so, Jeff. Have you got anything you want to add?
No, I don't think so. It's good coverage.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you very much for doing this. I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you.